4. The escort pilot who had just landed didn't understand what had happened either, and he was trying to explain it to the coordinator who didn't speak German. Johnny asked the German whether he had recorded the action, and the pilot said he had. Johnny explained it to them both, in English to the coordinator and in Cyclo to the pilot, that it was a device on the nose of that hidden patrol ship over there. And they had better gather this crowd up and take them into a room of one of these ruins and explain and play the discs for them so they wouldn't think the place was full of devils. Soothe them down. They could have a reception later. The crowd was trailing after the coordinator into a nearby interior. Johnny walked over to the tallneb. The creature was conscious now. His eyes, without his faceplate, looked blind. They saw in some different light band and needed correction filters. Johnny looked around and found the half-shattered plate and, keeping well away from the creature's teeth, dropped it over his eyes. It tried to snap at him. Johnny hunkered down and said, "We will now begin your narrative, the long, sad story of your youth, how circumstances drove you to crime, and how that fateful trail led you to this pitiful ending."
"You're mocking me," snarled the tall map.
"Ah," said Johnny, "we speak Cyclo. Very good. Continue your story."
"I will tell you nothing."
Johnny looked around. It was quite a drop from the top of that huge palace down to the valley. He carefully selected the spot and pointed it out. "We're going to carry you up there and drop you. See the place just at the end of the long gable?" The tall map laughed.
"I wouldn't even dent me."
Johnny was thoughtful for a while.
"Well, we're not really enemies of yours, so I'm going to reconnect the wiring on your ship, put a little remote control I have in it, and send you back up to the Volcor-class war vessel."
The tall map was silent, rather alertly silent. "So I just better get to work on the remote control." And Johnny got up as though to go to his plane.
"Wait,"
said the tall map.
"You really wouldn't do that, would you? Return me to my ship?"
"Of course. It's the civilized thing to do." The tall map screamed,
"You rotten foul cyclos! You would do anything, anything! There is no limit to your filthy sadism."
"Why, what would they do to you?"
"They'd shoot me down and you know it. And I'd sizzle and burn in the air friction."
"But why wouldn't they want you?" said Johnny.
"Don't play around with me," raved the tall map. "You think I'm stupid? You think they're stupid? I notice you didn't mention sprinkling virus powder all over me to infect the crew. You are a fiend, coughing my lungs out all the way there, writhing in agony as I fall, burning slowly mile after mile with the buildup of air friction heat. You just plain go to hell."
Johnny shrugged. "It's the civilized thing to do," he said, and started toward the ship again.
"Wait, wait, I'll tell you. What do you want to know?"
So Johnny heard about the travails of this double ensign Slitheter Pliss and his half-captain, Rogo Dieter Snell, and how stupid it was not to let a superior officer win at gambling. He heard a lot of other things, not really relevant, and then the double ensign said,
"Of course, Snell hasn't told the crew, because he'll take the whole prize himself. But it's rumored that there's a 100 million credit reward for finding the one."
"What one?" said Johnny. But double ensign Slitheter Pliss didn't have anything more on it than that. He explained they were waiting to make sure, but either way the combined force would eventually attack en masse. The commanders of the ships were gambling via viewscreen for shares of the loot, and Rogo Dieter Snell had already won the planet's people, he thought, though Snell often lied and one didn't really know. But for certain they would need transport and maybe have to go home for it. Home? Did he ever notice a bright star, really a double star? Must be very bright from here. Constellation above it looked like a square box from this angle. Well, that was home. 9th planet in the rings. The tall neps had only one planet. They were raiders of other planets. Slaves. That seemed to be all just now, so Johnny told him he wouldn't send him back to his ship. Not yet, anyway. Johnny had read that once a Tallnep bit, it took 6 days to develop more poison. So he got a mine sample bottle and a rag out of the plane and told the Tallnep to bite the rag a few times, and the Tallnep resignedly did so. Johnny put the rag in the bottle, and he put the lid on tightly. The Kendrick knew about snake bite serums. Maybe he could make one for Tallnep bites. Another escort plane had landed. It had a co-pilot. There was a mine site down the mountain, smashed now, but it would have an ore carrier, and they had spare fuel, so Johnny sent them down to check one out and fly it up here. He was taking this Tallnep and the patrol craft back. He also told them to see what the mine site could supply in the way of passenger carriers. Johnny looked up in the afternoon sky. He couldn't see anything in orbit, but 400 miles and daylight would make it invisible. An uneasy day. The coordinator and the German pilot had shown the pictures and had taken the crowd over to see the ship and explain the gun to them. The throng was leaving it now. Coming back toward Johnny, who was standing by the plane, they were within talking distance. Abruptly, as though on signal, they all dropped down to their knees and began bowing their heads to the ground. And then they stayed down. Johnny had seen quite enough people falling down today. "Now what's the matter?" he said to the coordinator.
"They are deeply ashamed. They planned a great welcome for you, and it all went splat. But more than that," said the coordinator, "they have developed a lot of respect for you. They had it before, but no."
"Well, tell them to get up," said Johnny a bit impatiently. Adulation was not any pay he was after.
"You just saved their lives, or maybe more," said the coordinator.
"Nonsense," said Johnny. "I was just lucky to be wearing a helmet with ear pads. Now tell them to get up." The German pilot was near at hand. It seemed that this was the day for embarrassment. He was explaining to Johnny again that he had dared not fire. A Mark 32's guns might have blown half that palace right down on the crowd and Johnny. It was an enclosed bowl here, and the blowback of the blast... Johnny shook his head and waved him away. The coordinator was introducing chiefs. A small man with a smiling Mongol face, wearing a fur hat, came forward. Johnny shook his hand. The coordinator said this was Chief Norgay, head of what remained of the Sherpas. They were famous mountaineers and used to run salt caravans clear across the Himalayas in Nepal above India. They used to be very numerous, maybe 80,000, but there were only 100 or two now. They had hidden high up in inaccessible places. There was very little food. Even though they were good hunters, the game was scarce in high places. And this was Chief Monk Ananda. The man was wearing a reddish-yellow robe. He was big, with a very peaceful face. He was a Tibetan, and they had a monastery in caves. Any other Tibetans that remained in the country considered him their chief. You see, even before the Cyclo invasion, the Chinese had driven the Tibetans out of their country, and they had gone to other lands. The Chinese had suppressed Buddhism. Ananda was a Buddhist. But the caves were very hard to reach, being way up a ravine in a peak, and the cyclos had never succeeded in rooting them out. The Tibetans were pretty much starved. They were unable to come out to flat places and grow much food, and even in this last summer had not been able to grow much due to lack of seeds. And this man here was Chief Chong Wan, head of all the Chinese that were left. Did Johnny know there used to be 600 or 800 million Chinese? Imagine that. There was another tribe up in North China who had taken refuge in an old defense base in the mountains. The base? The Chinese never finished it. It wasn't very much. There were only 100 or 200 up in North China. But Chief Chong Wan here had 350 people. They were in a valley that probably had been mined and the cyclos never went near them. But there was hardly any food. Nothing much would grow up so high. Awfully cold. No, we don't have any trouble talking with the Chinese. They preserved a lot of their university records and are quite literate. They speak Mandarin, an old court language. Johnny shook hands. They would bow, so he bowed, and this pleased the Chinese enormously.
Speaking of languages, said the coordinator, they have a little show for you. They're all over there, so would you see it now?
Johnny glanced a bit uneasily at the sky. An escort was up there, very alert. He himself was not too far from the plane. He sent the German over to stand by his. Yes, he'd see the show. He felt bad. All their banners were on the ground, their musical instruments upside down in the turf. About 80 people in reddish-yellow robes were sitting now in precise rows. They were some of Chief Monk Ananda's people. As Johnny approached, he could see that they were anywhere from 8 years old to 50. They all had shaved heads. They were boys, girls, men, and women. They were trying to be very solemn as they sat with legs folded under them, but a gleam of mischief was in their eyes. An old monk was standing in front of them with a long scroll.
We had trouble last spring, said the coordinator. Nobody, absolutely nobody, could talk to these people. Not in India or Ceylon, that's an island, or anywhere could we find any trace at all of the Tibetan language or this one. We really looked, but we solved it. Listen.
He gave a signal to the old monk. The Buddhist read a line from the scroll. The whole group sang out as one, a sing-song, but not a repeat. It was Cyclo. The old monk read another line. The group sang out the translation in Cyclo. Johnny was incredulous. The performance went right on, sing-songing along.
He's reading a language that was once called Pali, whispered the coordinator. That's the original language in which the canons of Buddhism were written. The monastery, for some reason, had in its possession a huge library of all the quoted tenets and words of Gautama Siddhartha Buddha, the man who started that religion about 3,600 years ago. And they are literate in that language. But it is extinct. So we got a chinko...
Instruction machine, finished Johnny, and taught them Cyclo from scratch.
And they converted it back to Pali? That Cyclo mine site down there is pretty smashed, but it had a dictionary and some other books in a fireproof safe, and they've been going like a racehorse ever since, so we can talk to them.
The sing-song was going on. They were speaking with a Chinko accent, just like Johnny and the pilots.
You like that, Lord Johnny? Said Chief Monk Ananda in Cyclo. They not only sing it out, they also talk it really well.
Johnny applauded them loudly and they cheered. He knew what he was going to propose here. Is this all of them? Said Johnny. No, there were about 40 more, but it was quite a scramble down here from the monastery. It took ropes and climbing skill and help from the Sherpas. The idea of a religious teacher's words of peace, as he had heard them in that sing-song, being put into Cyclo, where all such sentiments went unused, was marvelous to Johnny. Some musicians had recovered their instruments and began to play on small horns and long horns and drums. Some women had gotten fires going, and their slight amounts of food were being warmed. The pilots came back from the mine site with an ore carrier. Johnny got massive amounts of help, and they manhandled the patrol craft into the big plane and put the Tallnap in it, very securely strapped down.
There's a lot of aircraft down there, said Johnny's co-pilot. The Scots that hit it must have set off an explosive in the compound. They must have blown the breathe gas. The domes are scattered in pieces over about 5 acres. They didn't bother to blow up the ammunition and fuel dumps. The hangars are on a lower level. There are about 80 or 90 battle planes in there. Some are singed, but they look all right. There's a lot of tanks and machinery, and there are about 50 of these ore carriers, Lord knows why. Bunch of shop and storehouse material. Looks like they shipped a lot of bauxite from here. No live cyclos.
Johnny made up his mind. He went to his plane and put the radio on planetary. He called the American base, Dunaldin. Johnny remembered Dunaldin's joke. You didn't know I had 15 daughters. It's quite urgent they wed.
Got it,
said Dunaldin and broke the connection. Johnny knew he would have 15 pilots, even though not all were graduated, within the next 10 or 12 hours. Dunnell Dean knew where he was. The reception had gotten going now. People were over their shock. They were serving food. They were smiling as they passed him. More bows. Two escort planes were aloft. Johnny's and the third plane were ready to scramble. Evening had come, and they had found enough wood to make a fire. But an enemy would show on a view screen up in the sky. They made speeches. They were grateful to Johnny many times, and he was a welcome guest. Then it was Johnny's turn. He was flanked by a coordinator who knew Chinese and a monk who also knew Sherpa. Johnny had to speak in English for the Chinese-speaking coordinator and in Cyclo for the monk, and the monk had to translate into Sherpa or Tibetan or whatever it was, so it took a bit of time waiting, but not too much.